Okay, next on the agenda, we have Amy Hardberger, who is with Environmental Defense Fund. She's a lawyer who works, she splits her time between our water team and our energy team. And there we go. Thank you.
Good morning. As Laura mentioned, the original motivation behind the selection of the topic of this conference, I think, was that at Environmental Defense Fund, we recognized how much Texas had done in its conservation up to date, but then also realized the need for more advanced water conservation, looking at the fact that the Texas population is predicted to double, and that coupled with the impacts of climate change further stressing our water resources, sort of brought to light the need for the next level of water conservation. And recognizing also that the legislature has done a lot to set the standard for and set requirements for cities, encouraging cities to develop water conservation plans, what we decided to do was take a look at what was actually happening on the ground. And in order to do that, we reviewed 18 cities' water conservation plans that were submitted in the 2005 submittal process. And these were the cities that we selected. And basically, we chose them because we chose the top largest cities, the 10 largest cities in Texas. In addition to that, we wanted to choose a metroplex area that would share similar climatic information or climatic data. So we chose the Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex, and then we also chose a scattering of mid-sized cities to see how they would compare as well, and they would have more of a geographic distribution throughout the state that would give us some variation with climatic data and different populations and water needs. And that was sort of the basis for the report that you have there in your packet. And before I start, we sort of wanted to talk about, and this is further covered in the report, what the conservation potential is in Texas and why there is a need for advanced water conservation and why putting some time into water conservation, more water conservation, can have such a significant impact in our future. According to the 2007 State Water Plan, there's the potential for 612,000 acre-feet per year savings. Other calculations have shown that there's an additional 1 million acre-feet savings available. That 1 million acre-feet was achieved by calculating what would happen if all cities reached 140 gallons per day, per capita per day usage, which was what the recommendation was from the Texas Water Development Board Task Force, Conservation Task Force. So using that number, if those cities achieved that number and everybody came down to that number, you would have this additional savings. Of course, there's a lot of impacts associated with a savings that large that we'll talk about in just a minute. Also, the importance to realize that much of this conservation need really is only for a limited period of time. Usually it's the hottest days of the month, a limited period of time in the summertime that we're really talking about, at least for the near future, why we need this additional water. And if we can avoid increased infrastructure just for those few peak days, then there'd be a lot of both financial savings for the cities as well as for the customers. Another great conservation potential that I think was just mentioned is the cost savings potential. And the cost savings, as I mentioned, reaches both to the cities themselves, but also to the consumers. San Antonio estimated that for every dollar they spent on conservation, they saved between $4 to $6 on water supply and treatment. When you start looking at the cost of both new treatment facilities and the cost of new supply, this number really seems to have an impact. As we all know, construction costs are increasing just exponentially these days. And so if you can have the avoided cost of a treatment or a treatment facility or infrastructure, that can really have an impact on a city budget. Similarly, new supply is also increasing. In the San Antonio area, an acre foot of Edwards water has gone all the way up to potentially $5,000 per acre feet. Now, obviously, throughout Texas, water doesn't always cost that much, but even the Texas Water Development Board estimated that it would be between $400 and $600 per acre foot. So if you can avoid some of that cost through efficiency and conservation measures, that's going to have a positive impact on the city as well as the consumer. And not to mention, there's a whole load of co-benefits that come along with being able to conserve and use less water for municipal use. Of course, one of those is environmental uses. Most people in this room are familiar with environmental flows initiative and maintaining more water in the river's beds for ecology as well as for bays and estuaries, but also, as was mentioned by Marianne, the energy reduction that is associated with that. And so you end up having sort of a compounded both financial and energy savings, energy water sort of coupled savings, because every time you use water, you're essentially using energy as well. So if you can reduce your water use, you're actually getting this nice co-benefit of saved energy. So you have a double savings on your bill. Now, as we did this report and review of the 18 cities, we came up with sort of three major results that I want to review for you today. Obviously, these are explained in much more detail in the report. But one of the main ones where we saw a lot of variation between the cities in the gallons per capita per day target goals that are required in the submissions, in the water conservation report submissions. Cities are required to include both a 5- and 10-year target goal. Now, I should say on the onset that this can be a very controversial issue in terms of how you calculate your per capita day usage. Not all cities have the same infrastructure or abilities to get information to calculate this, and some calculate them in different ways. However, that being said, it can at the very least be used as an excellent qualitative comparison, such that if a city is using whatever structure they're using and they're using that same structure for their 5-year goal, you could still look at how much they're going to be reducing into the future. And it's that qualitative analysis that's really important here in looking at how aggressively cities are willing to reduce their water usage. As you can see, there was a lot of variation between the 5- and 10-year goals in the 18 cities that we surveyed. The 5-year goals ranged from 139 to 301, and the 10-year goals were from 116 to 294. And the number I'd like you to keep in the back of your head is the 140, quote, target goal that cities should be reaching according to the task force recommendations. The Texas average, which I got from the Texas Water Development Board on their website, has the per capita usage of 954 cities throughout the state of Texas, and I just ran an average of those, and that came out to be 172. I'm just sort of as a comparative point. Now, one of the really interesting things that we found in the per capita goals, 5- and 10-year goals, was that there was no correlation between the intensity of reduction and the quantity of use. And what that means is that the cities that were larger users, per capita users, didn't necessarily have more aggressive reduction targets. And on the flip side, cities that already had reduced their water considerably sometimes had more aggressive goals. Now, of course, what we'd like to see is the flip of that, where the cities that had the greater usage were trying to reduce at a greater rate. Many of the cities reflected the Texas Water Development Board's recommendation of a 1% per year reduction. However, reading that report, those recommendations, that 1% reduction was actually a minimum recommendation, but a lot of cities use that as the standard, even though they, after their 10-year goal, would still be using far above what the recommended 140 gallons per day recommendation was. Some cities, such as Carrollton, actually had an increase in their 5- and 10-year goals higher than what they're using today, and the 10 was higher than the 5-year, so obviously that's not what we'd like to see. One of the other things that's been touched on already, and I know will get discussed further because I think there's a lot of conservation potential locked up in this, is the pricing structures. Now, under Texas law, as most of you are probably familiar, it is prescribed that all cities have a conservation-based pricing structure. So basically an increasing block was what it was referred to earlier, so that the more you use, the more you pay, but in a block situation, not just per 1,000 gallons or per quantity. Now, we could really get into the weeds on all the things that we found on this, but I think that you should probably just read it in the report so we don't all fall asleep before the coffee kicks in. But there is one really important point that I would like to point out, and that is that one of the striking things that we noticed was that the blocks, as they went up, very few cities, I believe it was only two, exceeded what had blocks above what an average household would use. So an average household of four using only 140 gallons per capita per day for 1 month would use approximately 16,500 gallons a month. However, the majority of blocks stopped at 15,000 gallons. So that means that a water waster is not actually getting very penalized for using above that 15 or 20,000 gallon mark, which is where those are the people that you really want to be targeting. And that also, the other reason that you really want to be targeting these people, not just for water conservation, is that that's where cities can really gain some revenue for some of their other incentive programs. And that's where the pricing structures can really help cities financially, and I think Marianne alluded to that a little earlier. And what can happen is, I think that the city of San Antonio uses this, is that they're able to fund a lot of their non-pricing programs, which I'm going to get into in just a minute, by just taking the revenue from the top 2 or 5% of their users. So if the people that are using, you know, 50 and 60,000 gallons per month are paying I don't want to use the word exorbitant, but a lot more money than the average user, then that money can actually be used, and this is particularly important in smaller cities that do have revenue ties with their water income, and they're worried about how water conservation will impact their bottom line, is that a well-structured rate program can actually provide them with revenues and can also help pay for incentive and rebate programs. So these two things can really work in tandem, and obviously there's a lot of information out there that was discussed and will get discussed more on how that can happen. But that was sort of a surprising find. Which then leads us into our non-pricing structures. This is sort of everything from the appliance rebates to the plumbing retrofits to the lawn, the lawn programs, getting people to replace with drought-resistant plants, and education programs. And again, a lot of these are prescribed in Texas law that they have to be there. So all the water conservation plans had what had to be there. What we saw was that they were there in varying different levels. For example, skipping to the bottom, the public education, everybody had some sort of public education program. The difference was that some people had brochures available at the courthouse, and some people mailed things directly to people's homes. They went to city events and civic events. They went to churches. They passed these things out. It was a much more proactive approach. And obviously, that's going to be more effective. Other public education programs that looked more effective were regular bill inserts, as well as structuring the bill itself to inform the public about how much water they were using, both in comparison to how much they used last month and comparison to the average user. I think that was mentioned in the previous presentation. Most people don't know how much water they use, and they might not know how much water they used this month compared to last month. And it's that level of education that can really promote conservation, especially when you tie that to a financial impact for the consumer themselves. It's a great motivator as a bill payer. Now, for non-pricing programs, there's sort of three different ways that these can be implemented. You can have them completely voluntary. You just do a public education campaign. You ask people to please water their lawns less, et cetera. You can have incentive and rebate-based programs, which unfortunately we did not see in very many cities. Two or three cities did have several incentive and rebate programs for appliances such as washing machines, replacement, plumbing retrofits, and most importantly, turf replacement with drought-resistant plants. And that's something that could really be seen more. And then the third way is to have mandatory restrictions. And you did see this in some cities in terms of watering. Those restrictions might not be implemented year-round, but they might be during drought conditions. You could only water on a Monday and a Wednesday or something like that. So they sort of seem to be more have a greater impact as you move from left to right. Obviously, voluntary is a little bit difficult, and once you start putting rebate programs in, people get a little bit more motivated, and then obviously mandatory has its own impact. And then sort of looking forward to the 2009, and the past legislature added a large group of people that are going to now have to start submitting water conservation plans on May 1st, 2009. And in addition, all the people that had to submit water conservation plans in 2005 are going to have to submit plans to show how they implemented, what they implemented in terms of their previous plans, and if they didn't implement it, why they didn't, and what the results were. And so these recommendations sort of talk to this next round of submissions and how we can really maximize and energize people for this next round to sort of take it to the next level. And the first one is sort of a recommendation for the state itself on an implementation scale. Previously, the way that this has worked is that to meet your statutory requirement, you had to submit a conservation plan that had a certain list of requirements. And that was it. They were only reviewed in terms of completion. They weren't really reviewed in terms of the actual stringency of what the cities were willing to take on. And, you know, it would be great if the state, recognizing that they might need more resources or a reallocation of resources to do this, but that if the city could really look at the intensity of the goals that the cities are setting so that you don't have cities setting 5- and 10-year goals that are actually higher than what they're using right now. So that would have a very strong impact. Also, compliance assistance. It's recognized that there are large cities in Texas and there are small cities in Texas and there are everything in between, and everybody has different resources available to them and they can't all be brushed with one stroke. And we have a recommendation that the state come up with guidance documents for varying size cities, like a small, medium, and large, to really assist those cities that have less resources, both financially but also in terms of personnel, to be able to understand what is out there and how they can best maximize their water conservation. And also sort of tied into that would be to let these people know what materials are out there. There's a lot of great information, and some of these people might not know what's out there and could really use sort of some assistance in that, and that's understandable. At the city level, we encourage the cities to have more ambitious goals. I think one of the problems with the review process, and I've had a city mention this to me in the past, was that because of the way the submission requirements were, it sort of encouraged them to aim low. As long as you put something on there, you were gonna meet the requirement, and that was that. And most cities, I will say, are going far beyond what they said they were gonna do in their conservation plan. But what we'd like to see is a system where they actually set their high goals for themselves in their conservation plan, and that way in the implementation procedure and in the review process, we can see if they're really meeting that goal, which is ultimately going to be much more effective. And also within that, better pricing structures. The structures really need to be reviewed to see if they are as conservation oriented as they should be. And, you know, the target shouldn't be the average user. The target should be the people above that. And those are the people that are sort of being left to just pay the same amount per 1,000 gallons for as much water as that they want to use. And also, as I mentioned, an expansion of the non-price incentive programs. And that does dovetail nicely with the pricing blocks because, as I mentioned, that can create revenue to generate better non-pricing structure programs for rebates and incentives, and to increase our education programs and be more proactive and to look at some of the city's examples and how they were able to reach as much of their public as possible. And finally, as was mentioned in the previous presentation as well, the citizen needs to be more involved. Citizens really need to take responsibility for their water use. They need to participate in the programs that cities do make available to them. And I think that there does need to be a long-term realization that this issue is not for July to August, that this is a January to January issue that we're getting into. Water conservation in Texas is not a summertime issue, but a year-round issue. And hopefully working together, we can really have some positive impacts.
Have a little bit of time to take a couple questions. Is there any out there? Margo?
Amy, I heard you were an attorney, and we already heard a mention about homeowners associations and their landscaping. Is there any hope that something is going to be done about the power of homeowners associations?
Yeah, that's a tough question, and I might have to sidestep it, but a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I think that is probably a real issue and sort of an advanced policy recommendation that we need to talk about. I think that hopefully if we start getting more aggressive conservation legislation, they're going to have to start abiding by those as well. But it is very difficult when you see such a picture of a beautiful yard that, by the way, looks 50 times better than mine. To think, you know, that they would be in trouble, I think that's something that we really need to look at. Okay. It's a challenge.
In California, they did pass a law to prohibit homeowners associations from requiring turf. But how does that get enforced?
Right.
And so all the work on the books, now we can't figure out how to make it work.
Go tear off the turf in the night.
Okay, let's go ahead and take one more. Ma'am, right back here.
Where do you see the regional water bodies and groundwater?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and it's something that I think that we originally had wanted to incorporate into this, but then it started getting bigger and bigger, and I hope it would be a good follow-up piece, because I think that the next step is looking at the regional, the wholesale water distributors, the MUDs, and those sorts of things. But I mean, I think that there are a lot of creative ways that they can get involved. I think it's going to be a little bit different than the cities themselves, but you know, I'm not an expert in that. But I think that the sort of looking at how they work with cities, there could be a big impact. But that's definitely the next step in this process.
Okay. Well, let's thank you.